When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
And all beside and slumber keep, now when's to sleep, now when's to sleep, alas, and well may e'er and weep, now Connaught lies in slumber deep. Their lake and place are fair and free, mid rocks their guardian chivalry, and hounsy hall at Mandler liberty from crunching wind and lashing sea.
Trí kindle forasnat cach norcha, fír, eknad, ekna. Cláro mose seo de chalamó lochlin, tír hráhóir, sgláire, clódóir, sí. Nídach cúpla seachtanú hain áhna o cuidig a gréna kille a hehele na léchae, an fær oldánach, grávar, dayana seo, cara casement agus fic fíris, cara an fúca lénta sin James Stevens. Bhí chéad a scór blíans rastige, agus dag sé a rian ar éiring a linge, mar a jarvíin a chara seamas o de lárga.
Tóránig skéla vás kudum í lochlin, tóran óna an lé a kudiga. Agus mehan áti ar gulta hir a gunta fwyó. Fí sakarig dynamíntar agam mehamant ar chúid chige, tóreis filagum ar vlá kia, ach dvíta sach agam ásarum. Suine siri gravige, gahar gil na glóire. Tá híl colum an áilte a dáilig ar hóil. Agus is déin me gravi hana chara fi an án ma colum ná mwaren ar a géad duine a áisca a láv ar uscail gétíne vla hasta. Gur gár gur buníag kréf dan glasgadal, agus nach móide go darúd a cáirde na cláir sí cheal cláir secha, mar dertar gohfuil reisidíomh ar fáilthóil ach fis a chud ora. Níor bhuar aga agus uin ada chun scéal chuilimí Lochlin a riamha, agus a cheart a thuairta. Duine lách geanúil a ba chulam, agus tó cuidachta pé áit argamh sé. Á ráni bín agus gael gair liofa. Nír vistagum é haulú le carúl ildánach ó dála, filet an seachta vístiag, a tá umrájtach fós, e másk lucht skeltig inchint dan tannag rám, er a iltocht a dréhiv agus a gádana eag súla.
Vi kálir na leudid eil sig séf é chórhan na drí gynil. Vi kálir na balédich ar séf áldan bobl. Vi kallade heherer som de tangen gælge. Ach, kegur fær på bliegående i rive, bevjøgget du tje fæn rive dæva åge, nu de kasje er rurhagt en glusjagt i nasjumte hide. Buldanach en makke, mara vinig i grefur bæn ikke nedehuing.
We all lived in Rathgar all our lives, and he went to the Holy Ghost College in St. Mary's, and graduated from that into the university, where he did Celtic studies. He was always interested in Irish and in music and in all the folklore of Ireland. Well, my father was the proprietor and owner of O'Loughlin, Murphy and Boland in Dorset Street. And we all used to go in and out weekends, and Cullum got his wish for printing there. Then he started on his own in the what he called the candle press. in Hawkwood Street, in a house called the Craft Workers, where they had stained glass and arts and crafts, and Cullum had the back room there, and personally I set type there for him, and he published poems by Geraldine Plunkett and poems by Seamus O'Sullivan and quite a number of books.
He was one of the last links with the IRB, and he claimed to his dying day that Pierce never forgave him for going north on McNeill's instructions to cancel the rising. Previously he had organised Wicklow and had printed a seditious newspaper called The Spark. He had also been involved as a liaison officer in Kerry, a key man in the ill-fated effort to land Casement's guns. He took no part in the Civil War. The very thought of Civil War appalled him. Printing was in his blood, so to speak, and the books he published at the Sign of the Three Candles are regarded as the work of a master printer, Padraig O'Toilliur.
Well, Cullum's life in the world of books began, it could be said, in the winter of 1916, when, with Sean McGillenaugh, who was one-time editor of An Clath Salish and who later became a district justice in the County Galway, they formed the idea of publishing a series of booklets of Irish interest. They chose one of the Triads of Ireland, the one which describes truth, nature and knowledge as the three candles that light up every darkness. And this seemed a suitable legend for the sort of book he meant to issue. So the name of the three candles, Three Candle Press, was chosen, and a fellow craft worker, William MacBride, made the device of the three-branched Erlen candlestick, which afterwards graced the title page of the publications. The little firm moved about a bit in its early days. From Rathgar Road, where he lived, to Harker Street, and then to Dawson Street, from Dawson Street back to Harker Street, until eventually Cullum set up his own press in Fleet Street in 1926. He was delighted to find, by the way, that a large signboard hung over the shop door. This he painted with the sign of the three candles, and some years later, it's about 1932, he registered the name under the Companies Act, or whatever one calls the act which registers companies and their names. At any rate, Cullum, and indeed the public too, thought the name new and rather original. And many years passed before he realised that he was not the originator at all, only the reviver of the sign of the three candles. For in the years between 1730 and 1750, there was a Thomas Brown selling and publishing books in High Street in Dublin at the sign of the three candlesticks. Brown himself, by the way, was a marvellous character, one of the Catholic bookmen of the penal days, but, of course, that's another story. Cullum published well over 100 books, and he acted as a publisher for quite a substantial number of college annuals and commemorative volumes. It would be difficult to single out any one volume and say that this was his best work, but the book which stands out in my mind is Fáil Scríobhaíonn Óin Mhic Néill. This was a collection of scholarly studies of Irish interest. Oh, they range from folklore to archaeology and prehistory, Celtic languages, early medieval Irish history and so on. The whole collection was intended to honour Owen McNeill, and indeed it did this very well, to honour him on his 70th birthday. The volume was edited by Father Ryan, the well-known Jesuit scholar, and it was a handsome volume by any standard, and was laid out with exquisite taste. It's very scarce now. It is a thing of beauty. I think I started off by saying that Cullum began his life in the world of books about 1916 or something like that. But I wonder if it could really be said of any bookman that he began to take an interest in books at any particular time in his life. I rather doubt it. It could be said that he does, in a way, give the answer to this question himself in a commemorative volume issued about 1936 by the Dublin printing and bookbinding firm of Alex Thom. In this book, he quotes an old advertisement in a Dublin paper of the early 18th century, which runs, I have it here, "Wanted a man that has been bred to the vellum binding." One would want to hear that sentence from the lips of Cullum himself, to realise the feeling he had for fine bindings and for handcrafts generally. This feeling is reflected in the works of his life under the sign of the three candles. He welcomed modern innovations, but regretted that the pace of life was leaving behind the old craft hand-bind he loved so much. He gave voice to his feeling in this regard in the latter part of the 30s, and it is here that one can actually sense his feelings as an artist clashing with the modern systems of placing covers on books. Yes, covers. That's the better word than bindings, for the sort of thing I have in mind. To compare fine bindings with covers or cases is rather like comparing, well, shoeboxes with finely wrought jewel cases. Both could be used for either purpose, but each has its own place. At any rate, Colum put it nicely when he said, "So survives in these later days a remnant of that once glorious art which it marched out of the mists of antiquity, hand in hand with scribal work, and kept company with the art of printing throughout all its development. A sorry remnant, indeed, of a once proud handicraft which seemed, or seems, fated to disappear. For with the machine which dominates modern industry, it can make no compromise, being born of the living brain and moulded by the loving hand of man."
A present-day publisher, Liam Miller, director of the Dolman Press, pays his tribute.
I met Colum first shortly after I started the Dolman Press, which is 21 years ago, in 1951. But of course I had known his work for years before that. During my years in college in Dublin, I came to admire the books which came from the Three Candles, both from their scholarship and their content, and from the, to me, supreme quality of design, which stamped them all with a kind of unique flavour.
Was that something exceptional at the time?
I think it was exceptional in Ireland. In fact, all of Colum's output in publishing from the time he started the Candle Press in 1917 had the qualities of the man himself. He was a scholarly printer-publisher, more or less a Renaissance figure in the style of, let's say, Aldus, the great Venetian 15th-century publisher and typographer, who came to do something in Ireland which I think was very necessary through his own press, which was to give an image to Irish book production which it didn't have before then.
How do you think, technically, without being too technical, how do you think that he established his own style in printing and publishing?
Well, he came to it with a love of print and also a love of the text. The Candle Press started off with a series of booklets by Irish poets in its early years. They printed also a story by James Stephens, a little booklet called Hunger, which is now very scarce and desired by collectors. Works of a patriotic nature, writings by such figures as John Mitchell. These added up over the years to a very, very notable publishing list. And as the years went on, Colum's concerns for Irish matters became evident, both in the texts he printed and in the manner in which he printed them. His earliest printings in the Irish language were done by borrowing a classical typeface from the Trinity College Press, the typeface which George Petrie had made to print Irish texts in the middle of the 19th century. And eventually Colum came to create his own great Irish typeface called Colum Kill, which appeared in the early 30s. Beside all this, he had a concern, as I say, for scholarship, for the texts. He was a distinguished graduate of our university. In fact, he lectured in the university for many years, both in Irish literature and in the library school, in trying to show the qualities of and the background, the history of book production to generations of Irish librarians. All this to me added up to something unique in the way of a person. When I started my own press, Colum, in fact, sought me out because he thought that what I was trying to do, which was in 1950 to publish the emerging young Irish writers, was closely attuned to what he had been doing all his life. And I paid many visits to him at the Candle Press, and he visited me on and off, and we always talked about typography. As the years went on, we came to have mutual friends, not alone in Ireland, but, for instance, the great type designer Victor Hammer, who had assisted and advised Colum when Colum was making his typeface in the 1930s. I came to know Hammer in the 1950s, towards the end of his life. To accompany Colum's Colum Kill type, he had in fact adapted a typeface cut in Germany by Victor Hammer in the 20s, which was based on Irish character, Irish uncial writing. And this was adapted to make a display or titling font to accompany the text letters, which were the Colum Kill, which were Colum's own, I think, unique contribution. Colum Kill, I think, is a unique typeface in many ways, in that it is the first typeface cut of an Irish character which goes outside the boundaries. It acknowledges the fact that our great achievements in lettering were not, in fact, texts in Irish. If you remember that the Book of Kells is a Latin Gospels, and that it provides not only the 18 letters of the alphabet used in the written Irish language, but the full Roman alphabet. Colum designed his typeface along these lines. He designed his capital alphabet with an acknowledgement of the Roman origins of the capital letter forms. Other designers working towards Irish lettering had produced a capital alphabet, which was just an enlargement of the uncial, or what we would call the small letters. This, to me, was great typographic thinking. He also designed a sloped letter, what we would perhaps call an italic in character, to accompany his lettering, so that in producing a typeface which had the full range of equipment the printer would need, italic for emphasis or for special usages or for references, as well as what we might call an upright or Roman character, he gave to Irish typography in the 30s something which it had never had right from the beginning of printing in Ireland.
But I suppose it's true to say that it's as a collector and as a printer of ballads that Colum O'Loughlin is best remembered. His enthusiasm was infectious, his influence in this particular field very great indeed. In the preface to his first important collection of ballads, published by himself at the Three Candles, he wrote,
"One thing I can claim with confidence, that every song in the book can be sung by anyone who has the ordinary Irishman's ear for music. I have sung them all myself, and here they are set in keys to suit the average voice. Let the singer approach them with patience and sympathy. He must avoid all exaggeration of dialect and resist the temptation to burlesque, for it is fatally easy. He must sing them quietly and naturally, dropping a verse here and there if he will, but telling the story completely. He will soon find that he has a rich store of entertainment, of a more universal appeal than any repertoire of operatic or classical song, and a sure bond of fellowship with Irishmen the world over. Furthermore, he will have gone a long way towards gaining an insight into the life and thought of our forebears, and he will link up with the genuine Gaelic tradition which we are seeking to restore. When the Irish language was fading, the Irish street ballad in English was the halfway house between the Irish culture and the new English way. Now that the nation is retracing its steps, is it too much to hope that we may pause again at the halfway house to find there the simple enjoyment of simple themes, to recapture the rhythm and the idiom of Gaelic poetry and music?"
Some years ago, Ciarán MacMahona spoke to him about his songs and about the ballad printers of the Dublin of his youth, the likes of Dennis Devereux.
"He had no printing house of his own when I knew him, although at one time he had, with a man called Muth. who lived on it a couple of years ago. He was a linotype operator. And you'd see on the copies of the Daily Sinn Féin and the United Irishman, printed by Devereux Newt and Company, 57, I think it was, Middle Abbey Street. Yeah. Somewhere near where the side door of the Independent is now. Well, afterwards, when I knew him, he used to come in to me to get me to set an odd ballad for him. And he'd get somebody to make stereos of it, to add to those scenes. Nugent's ballad sheets were his. Mm-hmm. And he used the name Nugent as a publishing name. Another name was Ryan's Irish Reciter. That was done by him. The man from God knows where is in that and mm-hmm. other such things.
But his real name was?
Was Devereux.
Devereux.
Dennis Devereux.
Yeah.
He was never married. And I don't know where he lived, but it was somewhere up in the South Circular Road, I think, because he was making his way home on New Year's Eve one night, and apparently some weakness came on him, and he just shoved open one of the gates of St. Patrick's Park, and he was found dead there in the morning. That was the end of Dennis Devereux. But he had an extraordinary collection in his head of ballads, and he used to... He used to haunt Thomas Street in the days before Christmas, the oldest, listening to the ballad singers from the country and trying to get hold of their songs.
I meant to ask you that, because in your first book, you when you have this little supplement about Dublin ballads, you mentioned the place to hear ballads was Thomas Street on Saturday night, and especially on Christmas Eve.
Yes, especially on Christmas Eve. Old John Kenny, the piper, came in to me about the year before he died. Whenever he was up Rathgar, he'd come into my mother's house and he'd play for us there. He wasn't the best piper in Dublin, but his wife was the best fiddle player. She was the queen of Irish fiddlers, sir, he'd say. But he couldn't keep time unless he was with them. If he was playing with the wife or with other pipers, he'd keep it. But he used to wander off and his time was very erratic. But John Kenny, how are you getting on, Johnson? This was either the day before Christmas Eve. Ah, so said he. No turkeys, no geese, no crowds in Thomas Street. It's a bad year. Because the country carts used to come in there, and you know the carts with the spuds at the back, shafts at the back. Well, they used to be tilted up. The horses were taken away and stabled somewhere. And the whole of the front shafts used to be festooned with geese and turkeys. That was the way the country people used to sell the stuff, on the floor of the street, as they say.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was in Thomas Street.
In Thomas Street, yes. And, of course, Britain Street, that's Parnell Street now. That was another good place in those days. Because I got many a ballad from the ballad singers by it in the street. The night of the Ragman's Ball, I nearly shoot us in Britain Street, I got that.
Come, listen to me for a while, me good friends, one and all. And I'll sing to you a verse or two about a famous ball. Now the ball was given by some friends who lived down in Ash Street, in a certain house in the Liberties where the ragmen used to meet. Well, the names were called at 7 o'clock, and every man was on the spot. And to show respect for the management, every ragman brought his mutt. I must admit that I brought mine at 25 minutes to nine, and the first to stand up was Karen Grace for to tell me I was late. Then up jumps Pompey Sivdalum, and he says, I think somehow, be the way they're all going on tonight, 'cause I'm looking for a row. Now listen here, Grace, if you want your face, you better not shout or bawl. There's a lot of Hackshaws gonna be here tonight to respect the ragman's ball. Well, tis my one, you're a queer one now, and biddy your heart to be. When up jumps Eliza Boland, and she told her to hold her bright. Then my one made a cloud at her. She missed her and hit the wall. And the two of them went in the ambulance the night of the ragman's ball. Oh, of eating we had plenty now, as much as we could hold. We drank Brady's lukewarm porter until around the floor we rolled. In the midst of all the confusion, someone shouted for a song. When up jumps old Dunlavin and sings, keep rolling your burden along. Then we all sat down to some ham pairings when everything was quiet. And for broken noses, I must say, we had a lovely night. Black eyes, they were in great demand, not to mention split heads and all. So if anyone wants to commit suicide, let him come to the ragman's ball.
It was
working in Fleet Street in Dublin, in an electrical shop there, about 1957 or so. And Colin McLaughlin's shop, which was right next door, the sign of the Three Candles, the printing press. And a man who used to work from there, a fellow called Paddy Waters, brought me in one of his collections, the first collection of street ballads. And I was thrilled to get it. And it was what really started me off singing. And from that, of course, he produced the second book of Irish ballads. And it was a tremendous contribution to the Irish ballad revival, the Irish music revival, in fact, because with the singing of these ballads, they were always accompanied by a fiddle player or something like that who played in maybe a couple of reels or something in between the sound, you know, which gave ordinary people which had never heard Irish music presented in this way before, gave them a chance to hear it and appreciate it. And this way, I think he's contributed an awful lot. And I knew Colm quite well. I only met him in about 1964 or so. And I had several nice sessions with him. And very often I met him in O'Donoghue's, which is a pub where a lot of Irish musicians now go. But when I went there first, it was just a civil servants pub. And Colm used to often come in and see us there, Colm and his wife, and have a drink. And he was very, very helpful. If you wanted to know a song, he'd always invite you to go to his house and get it. He wasn't one of these people who felt that he was going to take the songs to the grave with him. He wanted everybody to know them.
Brandán Branagh, himself an authority on Irish folk music, was one of those who came under Colm's influence.
As a musician, I first made acquaintance with Colm something over 30 years ago. He was giving a lecture in the College of Science under some scheme intended to awaken interest in the national heritage. There was a tall young lad there playing the pipes. I discovered afterwards it was Seamus Ennis, so I can still hear Colm's voice and also the Seamus's music. Afterwards then I met him in the Clashgaddel, just a Saturday afternoon gathering, often 40, 50, 60 people there. Colm, Fionnán Colm O'Loughlinhane and Fionnán McCollum in charge, teaching songs. Often they'd have Hardebeck in there helping them at the piano, and other people occasionally turned up. I think they pressed everybody into service. Michael Bowles, I recollect, also been there on some occasions. These were intended to have to spread, popularise Irish songs among the people, and there were always, my recollection is that there were always cruel, happy kind of songs. I can still remember the whole 60 and the off, the top of the voice at Cutthroat Ní Chuin, Páirdín Ó Rafada, Praps an Ól, Sony Winnell and that type, so that people who were totally ignorant altogether, the music were encouraged and attracted by the melodies. Fine, simple, bold kind of things. This was an effort, we say, of Fionnán and of Colm in trying to propagate the Irish songs. Well, Colm, of course, too, filled another gap as far as singing was concerned when he brought out the Irish street ballads.
But as Brandán Branagh points out, not only was Colm a collector of songs, but he was a composer of Irish music himself.
That's not alone, we say, Colm's great achievement, that he got people singing these kind of songs, but really that there were songs and our songs being sung by people that who don't realise it was Colm himself composed the music to them. For instance, I wouldn't say that there is one in a thousand who could sing Sé Fáil Mó Uaire, or perhaps an ode to the original errors of these things as found in Petrie, say. Colm himself composed the air to which these two particularly are sung, and they were taken up immediately and altogether rejected or relegated the original airs. He also composed Doní Hishan Mehel na Fáilán Yála and the music for Cronan Mra Sléva. And in addition then, he composed the words for Núnz an All. He was
found no difficulty whatsoever at all in making verses of that kind, with the result that when you are confronted with songs from Cullum, you can be never quite sure occasionally as to whether the version was that as found by Cullum or whether, in fact, it was as improved by him. He was interested also in the piping. When he was a young lad at college, he was sick of the Cumann na Beibre, that's the War Pipe Association sound, it's around, from 1900-1912 it was in existence. And at the same time, he had a set of the other pipes, of union pipes, or Ilian pipes. He was able to play on both. He played a bit on the harp and he played a bit on the fiddle. But you might say that he was never a great piper because, with so many interests, Cullum had never much time, I say, to practice. But he did know all the old pipers, Dinny Delaney, Martin Riley, and these, and went himself learning music from Nicholas Markey, from Jimmy Ennis, that's Seamus's father. He had a tremendous amount of folklore about these people. And on one occasion he said to me, it's through a Mark College to the Wilson Gligan Show. That's, it's a pity if everything that was in this head was lost. So I was hoping that Cullum perhaps may have left a diary behind him. He was very interested in Kyole, a magazine which I had started. And in one of the early issues he wrote an article for me, Authority in Irish Music, I think it was called, in which he was very harsh, we say, on the efforts of the National University and what they had done and what they had failed to do, perhaps, for Irish music, so much so that they were compelled to defend themselves.
Small wonder that they might feel the need to defend themselves when Cullum came to the last paragraph of the Kyole article, the growl, as he put it, Marvullis Gwyd.
Is there in all Europe the like of it? In Dublin we have two universities, each awarding a degree of BMus or DMus. Young men, and perhaps young women, have emerged from these halls as BMus or DMus without the slightest knowledge of the Irish language, the bedrock of Irish culture, without the slightest interest in Irish folk music, the never-failing source of authentic Irish melody. Where did Grieg, where did Smetana, where did Bartok, where did Sibelius, where, to go further back, did Mendelssohn, Bach, Liszt, whence did any of them draw the inspiration that still charms millions? Where but in the folk melodies, the folk songs, the native music of their own land? Pitiable indeed is the DMus of National or of Trinity, who must admit ignorance of the native language, of the native music of Ireland. So, once again I ask, where shall we find authority in Irish music?
In all his activities, as a teacher in Scoileanna, as a ballad singer and collector, as a printer, as a professor in University College Dublin, he was always anxious to share his knowledge. Alf McLaughlin, librarian, bookman and balladeer himself, remembers Cullum.
You know, when I got into library service, I would have been, I suppose, one of the sort of young Turks. You know, and we tended to write off a lot of the work of our seniors. Ah, that's all just connoisseurship. You know, we want the equivalent in the book sciences of the guys who examine paintings with chemicals and this sort of thing, instead of just looking at them and saying they're beautiful. And the Irish Book Lover was a thing with which we principally associated Cullum's name at the time. The Book Lover was a magazine published from early in the century, originally from London. After the treaty, I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but about that time it came more from Dublin and was edited by Seamus O'Cassidy, who was another of these previous generation of book collectors and bibliographers. And Cullum took it over about 1930, and for 20 years he edited it. And we always felt that there was too much folksy stuff in it. Reviews of books, which weren't strictly bibliographical, and this sort of soft-line stuff, where we wanted the real hard-line stuff. But we realised afterwards, of course, that Cullum was perfectly capable of doing the hard-line work just as well as we were, probably much better. And that a person reading the Irish Book Lover regularly would be not only well-informed bibliographically, but would have a good deal of something humane and cultured about it as well. And this, I'd say, is the mark of Cullum, both as a professional, as it were, and as a human being. Cullum had left the teaching staff in UCD a few years when I was a student, and had left behind him, as it were, a textbook which my friends and I thought was a revelation, because having learnt nothing of Irish prose in Irish in school, except Scéalta Fíneachta and some of the purely modern materials, it was quite a revelation to find that there was in fact a dignified tradition of tasteful prose going way back. And Cullum's collection was again something which has all the scholarly apparatus that it should have, but at the same time is a book that anybody with, you know, honours leaving certs out of Irish could take up and read to enjoy. And there aren't that many books of the kind available in Irish. And we always felt a very warm spot for this particular book. Another interest it had for me was later on, when I got interested in the history of Gaelic type, that I found that most of my basic knowledge of it had come from facsimiles and so on in Tubberfield Gaelge. And there's a sort of a circular element in my relationship with Cullum, because a few years ago I was asked to re-edit a book which had been done 50 years ago on the history of Gaelic type. And as I came to the point of making an acknowledgement to the people who had helped me in it, I found, of course, that I had to mention Cullum, because anybody working in this must be in his debt. And I noticed then that Ned Lynham, the man who had written the original book in 1922 or 3 or 4, had also an acknowledgement to Cullum O'Loughlin, which gave an idea of the length of time he had been active in this field.
Cullum O'Loughlin was a hospitable host, and in his house in Rathgar Road, many's the man listened and learned. Bulmer Hobson and Casement used to sing The Lass of Richmond Hill as a duet, with Cullum accompanying them on the piano. Arthur Griffith could do a turn too.
Quite a number. He used to fill up the United Irishman or the Sinn Féin sometimes with squibs like that. That one that I have in the book there, The Pride of Pimlico, and of course the canal one, and The 13th Lock, and The Return from The 13th Lock, and the name he signed was Shangana. Mm-hmm. Martin Walton published a little book, a selection made by Piers Beasley, for either sixpence or a shilling, of poems by Arthur Griffith.
Yeah.
And he didn't claim that it was any way complete at all, because a lot of the stuff was unsigned in the paper, and it might be Griffith and it might not.
Yeah.
But meeting Griffith, you'd think he was rather a solemn person. That's if you met him on a specific occasion, if you weren't in the circle that used to carouse a bit with him, you would think he was a terribly solemn owl. But he had this streak of fun in him, just to break out in the ballads.
Cullum O'Loughlin seems to have been immensely popular with all those who worked for him, or rather who worked with him at his Three Candles Press. Paddy Waters, whom Ronnie Drew mentioned earlier on, remembers Cullum O'Loughlin.
I met him first in 1932 when he was doing most of the printing for the Eucharistic Congress. He was, about 40 years of age at that time. I was quite young. He was doing a lovely job. It was my first experience of seeing good colour printing. And in the curiosity of youth, I asked him, how did he do it? And he thereon took me in and explained the process. As I say, treated me as not talking down to me, but as an equal. Then we drifted apart for a number of years. I used to go in occasionally because he was running a very good bookshop in which there were quite a collection of books about the rebellion and its aftermath. One copy I bought of him was a small book of verse about the lads who were imprisoned in England. I would love to have a copy of it today, but it's out of print. In that was one poem that still remains in my memory, fragmentary, that was about a man who came to end up with no buttons on his trousers or on his jacket, where they were taken as souvenirs. He at that time became very interested in Anoige. He was very interested in young people. They used his premises in Fleet Street as a type of office. You could go in there and you would meet all sorts of personalities who at that stage were in the process of promoting the idea of an OIU with full encouragement from Colm O'Loughlin. He printed their handbook for many, many years. I don't know whether they still give it to them or not. But he done the layout of that handbook, which was very magnificent. You could go in and you could talk to him about it and he would tell you all about it. Then we drifted apart for quite a long time. We heard of one another from place to place. And in the 50s, we came back again together. I ended up doing a period of work for him. And in that period, we became very, very close. We discussed many things because we had many people that we knew of. One of the most interesting things at this stage was the publication of 50 Years of Liberty Hall. That book was compiled and in a very unique way. Four people got together twice a week and they argued and they talked about the period. Cathal O'Shannon, William O'Brien, Colm O'Loughlin and myself. It was very, very interesting because you had two people giving the point of view of the Labour and Socialist line. You had the other man, Colm, who had been a member of the Executive Committee of the Volunteers at its formation, giving his side of the story, telling the stories that he loved to tell to his intimates of having gone to Valencia and Holy Week to seize the radio station. Help not coming to him because of the people who are drowned at Bannerstrand who are on their way to help him. And his return to Dublin and being told on the station at Limerick Junction that Casement had been arrested. His story of the interview and argument between Pearse and MacNeil at which he was present as to whether the mobilisation should take place over the weekend or not. His dispatch from Dublin to Coal Island by O'Neill to try and stop the people in the north from rising. His period of working in the north of Ireland on a furniture van where he couldn't come back to Dublin. All these things come to mind when Colm goes. His publication of the ballot book in the 1930s. The one thing that will keep the name of Colm O'Loughlin alive, because he kept the ballads alive. And my opinion is that but for the publication in the 1930s of the ballot book, we wouldn't have the scene we have today.
And there was, of course, the private Colm O'Loughlin, and this man, his sons, Dara and Ruan, and his daughter Afric knew best. A kind man, an old-fashioned man, respected and loved.
He was a good musician, but not on the ordinary academic sense of the word. He had a fantastic ear for music and an amazing memory for lyrics. Considering the years that he, you know, the time period when which he spent collecting ballads all over Ireland, there weren't such things as portable tape recorders, and he obviously committed it all to memory. Made notes of the lyrics and committed the music to his head. When he returned to Dublin, he used to enlist the help of one Joseph Crofts, otherwise known as the Bard, and Colm would simply sing these things at him, is the only word, at him, and the Bard would proceed to transcribe and translate this into conventional music, dots and quavers, etc. The Bard was also renowned for having tried and failed to teach Dara the piano.
Yes, and also
was also renowned for being the only person that Colm would entrust the tuning of the family piano to. That was quite an event. It happened about once a month, or once every 2 months. But the event was always marked by a sort of family hold back on Saturday lunch, when a certain amount of food had to be preserved for the Bard. Mm-hmm. And this, as far as we know, was the only financial inducement which was ever given to him, either to come and play the piano or assist Colm in his musical activities.
they always ended up in good sessions, didn't they, with all sorts of tunes being played and nigger minstrel tunes and all sorts of strange oddities would be trotted out, you know?
True.
Yeah. Tell me something about the musical sessions he used to have. Oh, he used to have people like Dr. McSweeney, who founded the Cherry Orchard Hospital, and various contemporaries of his own from the University College, and people coming around for the evening. This is when I was quite small. Sometimes a bit hard to remember, but we used to sit on the stairs and listen to the music, and we'd finally get down to the drawing room and do our own little bit. But the songs were early music hall songs and things that normally wouldn't be associated with them as a ballad collector at all. And I think both our feeling for jazz grew from the ragtime, the tunes that he used to play with great verve and timing and swing in a certain way. And I think this is what we inherited from that side of the musical scene and ended up playing that sort of music ourselves, actually.
Does he approve of your jazz activities?
Not in the least.
Hated it.
It's always described as brothel music, and such phrases as, if you roll in the dirt, it'll stick to you, were, you know, quite common.
Yes, we used to have to creep out to jazz sessions. I remember putting the drums on the 15 bus, and when it reached Kelly's Corner, the drums rolled out in the street, nearly decapitating an old flower seller, and cymbals crashing all over the place. But this was a normal occurrence. We had to creep out and bicycles and drums and so on and so forth to play at our various venues. The lawn story, I think, is one that comes to mind, when the jazz band assembled with various friends and odd people on the lawn, full lineup, trumpet, trombone, clarinet, no piano, of course, I'd use a banjo on that instead, but and a sousaphone from the of all things, the RAF, who was over on the holidays. We're marching around playing some New Orleans ditties, and suddenly I heard the trumpet fade out, the clarinet fade out after that, the trombone, and then I looked around and fleeing for the bicycles under the hedge, and on the steps of the house was Cullum doing a sort of a war dance with the dressing gown. He'd been having a siesta during the afternoon. He, "Get out, you're mad, get out, the lot of you, get out to hell," one of his favourite phrases, "get out to hell," if ever you crossed him in this way. But it was amusing to find out from Detective Officer Byrne, who lived across the road and was a friend of the family's, that it was about 20, 30 years before that the police had to come up and order him off his own lawn for parading with the pipers banning and causing a nuisance to the neighbours.
What was he like as a father when you were young? There was a big age gap, wasn't there, between you?
There was. There were certain things that had to be observed. You certainly couldn't speak to him with your hands in your pockets. That was, in his eyes, a marked sign of disrespect.
Yes.
He disliked intensely any American phrases like okay, that was virtually forbidden.
And comics.
It was always corrected if it was used.
Hated comics.
Hated comics. Yeah.
They were even smuggled by us on buses from Galway out to Connemara to Josie Mongan's when we were staying there, hidden under mattresses and things like that. And we were severely thrashed for reading them. Not only did they contain rubbish, but they were badly printed. This was the great point there.
We end this programme of tribute to Cullum O'Loughlin with what his family told us was his favourite party piece, sung by his two sons, Dara and Ruan, and his daughter Afric.
Oh, 'tis of a damsel, both fair and handsome, this story's true, or so I've been told. In the glens of Antrim, in a lofty mansion, her father gathered great stores of gold. He built a dungeon of bricks and mortar, a flight of steps they were underground, and the food he gave her was bread and water, no other comfort for her was found. And every day he would sorely bait her, till to her father she thus began, "O father, father, won't you relent now, and let me marry the servant man?"
And the servant man said, "I'm often drunk, and I'm seldom sober, a constant rover from town to town. And when I'm dead and my days are over, come Molly is storing and lay
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com. Save big money.